going to kind of talk about some of the other studies that have not been featured as much on the plenary session, but like, for instance, the Crown study. This mm-hmm. study with what a hazard ratio like 0.19, very mm-hmm. strong. You have the patients with the ALK fusion. And so what are your thoughts about the Crown study for our patients with metastatic ALK patients?
Yeah, the Crown study was a really important trial that was presented at ASCO. And the takeaway points from this are the following. I think most community oncologists are probably comfortable using alectinib. It's been the standard of care for a very long time. There's 5-year overall survival data, and thankfully, it's a very effective drug for most patients. And I think as a thoracic oncologist, I'm very thankful that we have drugs like alectinib and even to some extent brigatinib in this space, because we have a lot of very highly effective tyrosine kinase inhibitors that can offer patients rapid relief of symptoms related to cancer and have relatively minimal side effects from the drug themselves. So lorlatinib came into this space as sort of a direct comparator to crizotinib. And one of the critiques of this study was that, well, why aren't you comparing crizotinib, which is a kind of outdated drug? And I still have some reservations about that. However, I do want to point out that while we think of alectinib as an excellent drug in the space, and it is, there is about a 20% intracranial progression rate in patients who have baseline brain metastases and did not receive radiotherapy at 2 years. This was a small publication that was Suresh Godgill put this out there. And so this is where I think Crown comes in. So at 5 years, the median PFS for the lorlatinib group in the Crown data wasn't reached. And I think part of this was because lorlatinib has excellent, excellent CNS control. The intracranial control at 5 years for patients with brain metastases is 83%.
Wow.
And if you didn't have brain metastases, it was 96%. So to me, the real take-home message wasn't the difference between lorlatinib and crizotinib, but just how well lorlatinib did, period. The other issue that comes up is a lot of oncologists and a lot of patients are really worried about the neurocognitive effects of lorlatinib. It's this sort of non-specific cluster of mood changes, potentially psychiatric issues, hallucinations, that can be very debilitating. And so one data point that I thought was really interesting here was if you looked at the temporary discontinuation rate in the Crown data, it was 39%. So something like 40% of patients were having to either hold the dose of lorlatinib or take a little pause. But the rate of permanent discontinuation at 5 years was only 5%, right? So what that tells me is a lot of these side effects that we're seeing with lorlatinib, we can salvage them by adjusting the dose properly. And they actually showed what a dose-reduced cohort would look like. And in fact, they presented that data in this presentation, which showed that even if you lower the dose to, like, let's say 75 milligrams or even 50 milligrams, you still get long-term control on lorlatinib. And so I think based on all of this, it's going to probably wind up being my preferred first-line agent. However, I would do it a little differently than the Crown data would suggest, which is I generally would start patients on a low dose at like 50 milligrams, and at every 2 weeks kind of work my way up to 100. Rather than doing the de-escalation strategy, I do this sort of baby steps in the pool towards the deep end. I have done that for a long time. I found that that strategy actually seems to work reasonably well. And one thing that's comforting in the ALK space is if patients really cannot tolerate lorlatinib, and there are some patients who cannot, I have comfort knowing that alectinib and brigatinib are acceptable alternatives. So you can always go back to those drugs, and I think they will be just as fine with those treatments.
Yeah, it was a game changer. I mean, if you look at the data, and then, you know, the other thing that was kind of interesting is if you look at the NCCN guidelines for these patients with ALK, it says if you receive alectinib or brigatinib and hasn't received lorlatinib, try lorlatinib. I think it was kind of interesting that was added on there. And so the other thing I think was kind of interesting in this space is the toxicities. Triglyceridemia. I mean, you just take a fasting lipid panel, kind of keep an eye on that. I feel like that's going to be well managed. So I feel like the hallucinations and neuropsychiatric and then in terms of triglyceride, but overall, from what I've seen, it's well tolerated compared to the other medications.
Yeah, it is. And it's dose dependent. I mean, the big side effects in my clinical experience with lorlatinib have been peripheral edema, weight gain. And the weight gain is really interesting. It doesn't actually seem to be associated with edema. So unlike the MET inhibitors like tepotinib or capmatinib, where you can get a lot of weight gain, but that weight gain is really tied to the peripheral edema that comes from that class of drug. This seems to be more of a polyphagia, or the people just gain weight either because they're more hungry or they eat more, and there's some element of peripheral edema. And it's a chronic issue, so you may not even notice it in the first 3 months. But if you see that same patient like a year out or 2 years out, you might notice that like they actually have gained weight. So weight gain is a big problem. I think almost every patient of mine is on some kind of statin. I think it has to, your triglyceride levels are just so altered with lorlatinib that I don't think it's really sustainable. And for the patients who can't tolerate it, I might do natural things like red yeast, rice, or something like that. But really, they need to be on a statin. And then the last side effect is this neurocognitive side effect, which is actually dose dependent. So that's where I really do recommend that if patients are telling you like, hey, I'm not feeling straight, I think I'm like more moody, or I'm really cognitive slowing is the what they say. It's like, I'm able to function, I'm just slower. And that is certainly an effect of lorlatinib and can be modified the dose.
That's why I like your advice, just kind of start at a lower dose and go up. That way you have like patient buy-in. So along that line, Tejas, you know, just kind of thought about like the, you know, how these effective medications are moving earlier and earlier. And so you got the ALENA study there where you had these patients with the alectinib. I guess just so slowly, everything's kind of moving on up, right? Like you're getting to the adjuvant setting, especially with lorlatinib being so effective. Is this something that you see moving on up, very similar to osimertinib in terms of the EGFR space for the ALK?
It is. There's a really important distinction between ADAURA and ALENA. So the big distinction between the two is in ADAURA, adjuvant chemotherapy was optional. So there was some proportion of patients in that study who did get adjuvant chemotherapy. And in ALENA, it wasn't. You went straight to alectinib. There was no adjuvant chemotherapy. And so that gives me pause, because I think we are omitting a treatment that, while it doesn't have a high impact on overall survival, and if you look at the LACE meta-analysis, we're probably getting around 5% overall survival benefit. It's a replicable overall survival benefit. You know, the LACE meta-analysis of at least 5 large studies, and there have been several others that have consistently shown an OOS benefit. Like, even if you look at the ADAURA data and you break down the OS data by whether patients got chemotherapy then osimertinib versus osimertinib alone, that group, the patients who got chemo and then osimertinib, did better. And so it's a conversation I have with patients. I would never force anyone to get chemotherapy, but I would say, look, if you're 43 and you want to be maximally aggressive, this is how you become maximally aggressive. And so that's the one contrast I want to draw at the ALENA study. I think in terms of long-term trends, yes, I think we're going to start to see a lot of these EGFR, AL, ROS, RET kind of studies where you're having TKIs. My question is really going to be whether finite duration of TKI makes sense, given the relapse rates we're seeing with some of the MRD data that was presented at ASCO. I'm not entirely sure. I would love to see that if they finish their time on osimertinib or alectinib, maybe those patients start some kind of MRD monitoring protocol so that if they become MRD positive, we can intervene earlier. That, at least in the abstract that I discussed earlier, the median time from an MRD positive event to a DFS event was about 5 months. So you might get a 5-month lead time by doing this. That is an ongoing question.
Yeah, great points there. You know, the other thing that we need to kind of think about for you as well is just, how are you going to get phase 3 studies with all of these small mutations? And so then the question is drug development, right? You're going to move all these patients up, then the leaders in the field like yourself and all the thoracic oncologists are going to have to deal with the toxicities, because toxicities is the number of patients that are on study. So you might have some of these toxicities that may show up later, kind of like immune therapy associated hyperglycemia or something. But is that something that you see, Tejas, since we're not going to have phase 3s for all of these different gene mutations?
No, I don't think so. I mean, so for example, ROS1 is an illustrative example of this. In the metastatic setting, the drug entrectinib, which is one of the first-line options for ROS1-positive patients, was approved based on a pooled analysis of multiple studies. It was not approved based on a phase 3 randomized control study. And it was done so, and the FDA justified this in part because of the rarity of these tumor types. So now we're asking to run replicable phase 2 and 3 studies for all of these. I think, and the discussant Alicia Sequest really mentioned this as well, is we need to start thinking about these more conceptually and less about whether each individual drug does have a specific designated trial. So I think a basket study would be really wonderful here, or something that could be done through a cooperative group like Alliance or SWOG to answer these type of questions.
And I think that's why it's so important to do clinical studies at large NCI, NCCN, Category 1, comprehensive cancer centers like they do, like you guys at the University of Colorado. So any last thoughts, Tejas? I really love that conversation today. Any other studies that kind of caught your eye or anything else that you want to kind of share with our OncLive MedNewsWeek audience?
Yeah, this was a really great conversation. Chandler, thanks for having me on. I guess a couple of small abstracts that I think would be worth highlighting. We didn't talk about PALOMA-3, but just to point out that for amivantamab, that trial really showed that maybe the sub-Q administration might be more effective than the IV. And I know that's been an ongoing challenge for a lot of practicing docs, infusion-related reactions that come from amivantamab. And then the post-infusion monitoring can make it a difficult drug to deliver. So I really am excited to see some more sub-Q data be presented. I think that's one abstract that's important to flag. The other one was something that got buried and didn't get a lot of attention, but I think it's actually a really useful study and probably has a lot of impact on our practice patterns. So one was, there's two. One was NRG-LU-002. This was whether maintenance systemic therapy versus local consolidative therapy in oligometastatic non-small cell lung cancer. This is specifically looking at patients who receive IO-based therapy. The real punchline here is that adding local consolidated therapy does not improve survival. So if you're on pembrolizumab and you're having, quote, oligo progression, at least based on this study, it doesn't seem that adding locally consolidated therapy improves overall survival, which was very counterintuitive, very surprising for me. And so it really sort of suggests that we should think about patients who are on TKIs very differently than we think about patients who are getting chemo or immunotherapy. The other study that I thought was kind of a smaller one, but worth highlighting, was a study called the BLOSSOM study. And this addressed an ongoing question that I've had for a very long time. The BLOSSOM study was a study that looked at patients who had leptomeningeal disease. So first of all, any study that's looking at leptomeningeal disease is great because there's just such a paucity of data here. And it showed that if you treat those patients at an 80 milligram dose. So these are patients who've never received a prior EGFR TKI, and you give them the 80 milligram dose, they actually have pretty good CNS efficacy. And the CSF to plasma ratio is actually really reasonable. And so to me, this suggests that we should really never start patients on 160 milligram dose of osimertinib. Now, it doesn't address the issue of if patients progress in the brain or the CNS. So let's say we started them at 80 milligrams, and now they're having intracranial progression. That's a different topic, and that wasn't addressed in this study. But I do think that it addresses the question that some of us have seen patients start at the 160 milligram dose. I know I used to do that in the past. I think this data pretty convincingly shows that 80 milligrams is a CNS active dose, even in leptomeningeal disease, and that if you're having CNS only progression, then maybe consider dose escalation. But I thought that's a small study that was kind of very useful, immediately practice applicable.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. Going back to the bispecific antibody there, you know, the abosumil, and then is it the medication is very similar to osimertinib, like lazertinib or something like that? They're both, isn't the indication, and this is something that I'll kind of rely on you on, is it an EGFR 20? So do you think it'll get like the 19 and 21, like the osimertinib, or how would you kind of help out the general oncologist here? Because it seems like you have the exon 19, exon 20 for the osimertinib, and then you got the insertion mutation for exon 20? Yeah. Is that right?
It gets very complicated. So I'll keep it simple. Basically, if you have an exon 19 deletion or an L858R, those are what we call drug sensitizing or classically sensitizing. And those are drugs where osimertinib would really work. Lazertinib is not yet FDA approved, but in principle would also have activity against those. So I would think of osimertinib and lazertinib as relatively comparable here. The exon 20 insertion is where you need to be a little bit careful. So there, the drug combination that has the most efficacy is amivantamab plus chemotherapy. That's what's been studied, and that's actually where most patients who have those exon 20 insertions should be getting amivantamab or chemotherapy in the first line setting. And then I think the hard question is, what do you do about these patients with atypical mutations? There was a lot of data presented at ASCO. There's some data suggesting amivantamab is effective. There's been data showing that afatinib is effective. So the optimal therapy for these, quote, atypical EGFR mutations, and these include G719, L861Q, for example, it's not really well-defined at this point. I think there's a couple of options you could use here, depending on patient preference.
The key thing that you mentioned that's a game changer is the sub-Q formulation, because now the toxicity is a way much lower.
Yeah.
And so that's going to really help out with our patients. Maybe some edema or something like that, but it's much more manageable. Is that something you've seen in your practice as well with the sub-Q change?
You know, we weren't a site that was participating in a lot of these sub-Q studies, but when I have conversations with investigators who were part of the Paloma 3 trial, yes, that's what they've seen. It's a lot more tolerable. It's a lot more easier to administer from a nursing standpoint. So I think once that gets approved, it will probably have rapid uptake. And I don't know what they're going to do with the IV formulation. I think it's something that will probably get phased away as sub-Q starts to get more readily used.
Well, I'd say, Tejas, thank you so much. I mean, we're so fortunate to discuss all of the data here and your studies that you mentioned, man. Thank you so much. Any lasting thought for our audience? I loved having you.
Oh, Chandler, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. ASCO 2024, there's a lot of data. And so it is and can feel overwhelming. I think the biggest advances were in the EGFR space, the ALK space, and the small cell lung cancer space. And we covered a lot of these abstracts in today's conversation.